another kind of visible. Poor man is up for money.
One of money.
But if he wants to become rich, he has to struggle in so many ways. Actually, that is not a valid, this is not a valid counteractive process, but a snare. A snare of the illusory energy. If one does not endeavor to counteract his situation, but is satisfied with his position, knowing that he has obtained his position through past activities, he can instead engage his energy to develop Krishna consciousness. This is recommended in all the Vedic literatures. Tatshaiva heto payateta kovido nalabate yat brahmatam upayatha labhyabhyate dukhavat ayata sukham kalena savatra gabira ramasa. Translation: persons who are actually intelligent and philosophically inclined should endeavor only for that purposeful end which is not attainable even by wandering from the topmost planet, Brahmaloka, down to the lowest planet, Patala. As far as happiness derived from sense enjoyment, as far as it is concerned, it can be obtained automatically in course of time. Just as in the course of time, we obtain miseries, even though we do not desire them. Bhagavad Gita 1.5.18. One should simply try to develop his Krishna consciousness and not waste his time trying to improve the material conditions. Actually, the material condition cannot be improved. The process of improvement means accepting another miserable condition. Read that over again. The material conditions cannot be improved. The process of improvement means accepting another miserable condition. However, if we endeavor to improve our Krishna consciousness, the distress of material life will disappear without extraneous endeavor. Krishna therefore promised, Kanteya Patija Nihi Name Bhakta Panashati. O son of Kunti, declare it boldly that my devotees never perish. Bhagavad Gita 9.31. One who takes the path of devotional service will never be vanquished despite all miseries of the body and the mind, and despite all miseries brought about by the other living entities as providence, miseries which are beyond our control. This purport and verse can be easily misunderstood. We remind ourselves about the miseries of Adiatmic, Adidevic, and Adibhautic. Different combinations of miseries attacking us in different ways, absorbing us in different ways. Miseries from our own mind, miseries from other living entities, miseries from the atmosphere, nature, from the devas. All of those miseries attacking us in this lifetime, and those miseries have set in certain karmic patterns that's following us. Some we've already encountered in previous lives. Some are waiting around the corner. Our parabdha karma, parabdha karma. Some are in the kunti or the bija in the seed form, and some are even before. Vishnu Chakravarti explains, some have not even manifest into the seed form yet, but they're surely there. Then we may wonder, if miseries are constantly a part of being in this material body, material world, then what's the big difference in having a spiritual lifestyle, engaging in spiritual rituals? You're still going to be miserable in certain ways. You still have to grow old, still have to experience disease, and one still dies. Some people, their conception of religiosity is that you make some prayer, you go to some church, you go to some spiritual person, and therefore they take away your sickness. You go to an organization and you do whatever you're supposed to do, and it brings you some wealth. And for many people, if a religion can't do that, what is the value? If you're going to commit yourself in certain ways, you're still going to suffer. Then why waste the time committing to something when you're going to suffer anyway? And on top of that, if we accept karma, then we know that to a certain degree, whatever struggles you make, you're going to have a certain kind of happiness in your life, certain kind of disappointment and suffering. Then one even wonders, why even be so concerned about God? Why be so concerned about Krishna? As like Krishna was explaining, and was confronted in the lifting of the Govardhan Hill with the karma kanda or karma mimamsa philosophy. Everything is karmic, and so why be concerned about samam bonam when you do something and you're going to get some result? And after all, the sun shines on the good and the bad and the ugly, the rain. What's the big deal? Making some special endeavors. You make special endeavors, you expect some special, distinct results, different from what other people encounter. Yes, some definitely aren't, some aren't. We can lose faith if we think that by taking to Krishna consciousness, these things will no longer be a part of our life. Sometimes they become even more intense in some ways as we go through the cleansing process. Sometimes they become more as we endeavor in different ways on behalf of trying to bring about transformation on the planet. We do remind ourselves how the great acharyas had more confrontations than we can ever imagine in our own lives. But often, as Prabhupada explained in the purport, as we try to bring about solution, resolution, we bring about more confusion. We've all unfortunately had the experience of telling a lie. Sometimes when you tell a lie, you gotta tell another lie, and another lie, and another lie, because you've gotten something going now. And you have to tell a series of lies to try to maintain seemingly some credibility about the fact that it's you try to cover up for the lie that's been put out there. It's in the atmosphere, it's in the air now, and you have to keep it going. You have to protect it. To protect it, you have to do some finagling, some juggling. You tell another lie, it makes it seem like that one is okay, so it keeps moving. It's not disturbed. But the end result, ultimately, especially karmically, is that there's more entanglement. One thing was done wrong, and now you've added to it. And now there's more inauspiciousness that one has to deal with. So we hear constantly, Srila Prabhupada and the acharyas explain to us that we should not be involved in this over-endeavoring, because it will cause vinashati phara, achahara payasyascha, pajapaniya magraha. That, why? But then life means endeavors. And then we're told, you must work hard. can we deal with this kind of contradiction? We must work very hard. We must be very mindful. We must be very conscientious. We have to be bold. May Bhakya Panashti. My devotee shall not perish. So we should be bold, knowing that Krishna is going to protect us. Like the cowherd boys who ran into Agarsua's mouth. They were bold. Krishna will protect us anyway. But then we are not to be foolish. And we are not to over-endeavor. And we are not to take Maya for granted. And we are to try to avoid associating with environments and people and circumstances that may entice us into certain kinds of deviations. At the same time, we're told to preach everywhere, every town, every village, every city, every person, and to do it joyfully, not to be lazy, to have compassion, so to inconvenience ourselves in the process because we want to help others. What is sometimes a little ambiguous? Where does free will? And it's a question since, you know, time immemorial. Predestination versus free will. Sometimes people think, oh, all of these Vedic followers, they're fatalists. Say it's karma. And so you have your show karma, Prabhu. Like yesterday, as we were talking about the community and how it takes a village to raise a child and a community to raise a devotee, and looking at so many intriguing situations, third cultural children and different challenges that adults as well as children experience, and how to name them, face it, feel it, release it. We don't want to talk about these things just to talk about it and hear it, and nor do we want to deny such things. So then why do we bring up these things? So we can understand it better, so we can avoid some things from the past. It didn't work so well, so we can learn from the past, look to the future. Do we want to forget the past? No. If we forget the past, then we repeat the past. Do we want to live in the past? No. We don't want to live in the past based on the bad or good things. Sometimes people live in the past based on good things, and they're never fully present. They never prepare probably for the future. Talk about, oh, how wonderful it used to be when I was a new bhakti. How wonderful it was so many years ago. How wonderful it was when there were 50 devotees in the temple instead of 5. How amazing it was when Prabhupada was on the planet. Yes. All of those things. But we have to live today. It's not that we say, oh, how wonderful it was. Last week, had a wonderful pizza. It was so wonderful. Yeah, last week, the Sunday feast was marvelous. It was so wonderful. But we got another Sunday coming up. You have to prepare. And it should also be wonderful. And if possible, even better. So we don't live in the past. The people who do, they're out of sync with reality. Some people do that, though. They just hold on to something in the past. They're afraid to accept that they're growing old. And they're 70 years old and they're still wearing mini skirts and certain things they did when they were 20 and 30 and men doing similar. Or there has been, and somehow they haven't accepted that it's time to retire. It's time to now go into a life of renunciation. It's time to move aside people's attachments, to denying the fact that life is about change and transformation. So we don't want to try to fix something and make it worse. We don't want to try to relieve our miseries and sufferings just to bring on more miseries, more sufferings for ourselves, for our families, and also for our communities. There's story about a king showing how when Krishna is satisfied, everything else is in place. And we know that if you water the root of the tree, the whole of the plant, the whole plant is nourished. The king was giving out boons, opulences, facilities to members in his kingdom, and especially to his ministers who have been very faithful. It says in the Mahaprakash when Lord Chaitanya was calling forth the devotees and was offering them a boon one after another. They were of course not interested in any. In many cases they were just showing how they only wanted to always think of the Lord, always be in association, he said. And we know the demigods, they offered their boons. People were eager to get some boons. People were eager to get a raise, to get additions or promotions, and they get something because they've been serving for so long, and, you know, get something extra. You'll like that. It's a sign of that they're valued. You know, their normal salary, they work, they do this, do that. Yeah, they expect that, and you expect to give them. But you give them something additional, showing your appreciation, going a little out of the way, the extra mile. People feel good about that. The devotees, and as good human relations, should not just do what is expected, but go beyond the ordinary to show the Vaishnavas how we appreciate them. This inspires each devotee in his or her service also. Otherwise, the devotee feels, oh, I'm just used to do this, do that, and people don't care about me. They call me up and tell me, I want you to do the offering this week. I want you to do this, do that. I want you to have fundraise. Yes, that's necessary. We should plug in and do various things. But we also should be encouraged in our devotion and appreciated by individuality while we work collectively together in trying to push on the movement with some austerity. Austerity must be there. So, different ministers were getting something. Someone was wanting money. Someone was wanting to build a house. Someone was wanting to have something given for their children. Someone was wanting gold and silver and so many things. And the king was arranging. Somebody else asked for land. And then one rather simple brahmana, he just said, oh, Your Excellency, I just want you to bring your lotus feet into my house. King says, yes, yes, but what do you want? He said, that is all I want. I simply want the touch of your lotus feet in my little cottage. You come and visit. He said, no problem. Such and such a time, some months and months in the future, I'll be in your area, and I will come visit your house. So when the king's attendants heard how the king, during this part of his rule, would be visiting that area a certain time, and would connect it with also visiting the house of this brahmana, the king's planners had to really go into motion right away. Because when the king stays somewhere, there has to be proper facilitation according to the king's needs. So the king was going to either stay there and stay overnight and do a few things and then go. So they had to go ahead and they had to fix the roads and they had to fix the house and they had to do this and do that. Knowing the king likes to walk around, had to make nice gardens for the man's property. Knowing that the king was going to come with other personalities, entourage, they had to fix in some extra bungalows. There's so many things. It's like when the Pope comes, the President comes, they sometimes spend millions and millions of dollars for one visit. the security, and they had to fix things up a little pucker, make things look a little nice, so that the president will be received nicely. And it's like, it can become amazing endeavors for just one visit. Probably they bring him in a special airplane, and they have to have special arrangements to see, make special handicap arrangements, so many different things they have to go on, all kind of security. He likes to eat this, so they have to ship in this food stuff, this medicine, you know. So many guards go ahead of him. They have to have people come with them. They have to be careful. They have to walk through the whole environment where, you know, where would the ceremony be, and how is he going to come in, and how would he leave. Some people walk through the whole scene. He set everything up. So, as you can understand, this Brahmin was very intelligent. Instead of him asking for one thing, instead of him saying, just help me to, you know, give me a little more land, or give me, you know, make a better cottage, you know, give me a better house. He was thinking about how he could get so many things, his village, the benefit, so many different concerns. Knowing that if the king comes, if you get the king, you get all of that. So this is really Krishna consciousness. That if Radha Kunja Bihari are pleased, everything else that is necessary and healthy for a person will fall in place. Doesn't mean that you get, you know, what you want, but it means you definitely get your needs. So in all of our endeavors, we must constantly remember, if our guru and Krishna are not satisfied, then we're like the person who's telling the lie, and we have to just keep on telling lies. Or we like the Brahmin who was concerned about his kopans, and then he gets a cat, and then he gets a cow, and then he gets a wife, and so many things, one endeavor after another, and just trying to fix one little thing. He was putting forth a lot of effort, but was surely getting all kinds of diminishing returns, to the point he just got so entangled. But he forgot what he was really about. Maya has amazing ways getting us so occupied with something that's real and genuine that we can just forget what we're really supposed to be about. So this is again a difficult balance of being conscientious, taking one's life, one's spiritual life, in one's own hands to do what is necessary with the help of Sadhu and Guru and Krishna, obviously. But at the same time, realizing how we must be so careful about what we put our energies into. Otherwise, we do the opposite. We distract ourselves from what we are to do and be, and we even take away from some of our previous credits. We start, you know, withdrawing until our bank accounts get very weak. And this is where you have fall downs and all kinds of deviations. Even though one has been active, pretty active on the royal path, but if we don't keep protecting the devotional creeper, then, it'll be weakened. So I started last night, but I didn't get into it because I wanted to focus mainly just about the children. But I'll end with this small reflection, you know, from Bhakti Siddhanta. I think it's very relevant these days, almost more than any other time, about what works. There are different ways to look at, you know, how we can be more emphatic in our spiritual growth. And he talks about what will really bring about real change that is not expressions of over-endeavoring, or does not cause us to get diminishing returns. But Paravati Muni, I think, talks about this also. He gives the example of a cow, you know, being tied to a post. And so this is where, again, we're going to make the discussion first of free will, you know, versus predestination, the way karma works. Because however we endeavor, we also have a certain karma, a certain amount of happiness, a certain amount of success is going to be part of our life. But we don't just have a sense of complacency and accept, well, I have my karma and this is going to happen. Yeah, that's there. We have our individual karma and we are part of, you know, an environment and a culture that has certain potency as it is and what it can be. So the example, and this I was explaining to some of our devotees sometime back in Gitanagari, as they were taking workshops and different things. And I'm really for these, you know, seminars and workshops and self-help stuff and all these things, but to a limited extent. They're really good when devotees understand how to use it and can Christianize and do whatever they can and help. It's very much needed, especially to stamina movement. And to the degree that our spiritual, our sadhana is not sufficiently strong, then we need certain things to help to build it up. I mean, kind of an example is like sometimes people have a sickness, physical or either mental sickness. It's like an example of mental sickness. Sometimes somebody has, you know, very heavy depression. And depression is comes in many, many situations. It's philosophical, it's biological, it's sociological, it's based on we codify things. It can be thyroid, it can be just so many things. You know, nutrition. Anyway, sometimes, because the person has been in such a depressed state, it has transformed, it has had some physiological transformation in, you know, in one's existence. With one's body. So therefore, sometimes medication is helpful to help to kickstart the process. Just being on medication, no, you're not going to go any place ultimately. But sometimes, even though one is not into medication, sometimes medication is helpful because of the depression having made certain biological, chemical transformations in one's existence. And so the medication helps to kickstart, so then one can then take herbs or go through talk therapy or process, do this and do that. So, I don't know how I get to that. But anyway, sometimes something is necessary to open up for other things. Now, karma is very interesting because there are times when we have ability definitely to be able to change something. And so we need to do what's necessary so the change can take place. But still, there are limitations. There can only be change by transcendental involvement. Somebody takes this real estate course and they become a multimillionaire. Another person takes the same course and they just lost another $5,000 for paying for the course. Why? Somebody takes this workshop, seminar, and like a different person. Someone else, it's just the 98th workshop they've taken. Somebody benefits extremely. Somebody else, merely. So, what Prabhupada Muni explains is like the cow tied to the post of a rope. So the workshops and the physical endeavor, mental endeavor and all that stuff, it's like the cow here, I'm sorry, the post, the rope. And so there's so much play within this rope. So all this work and the physical stuff you do and social and all that stuff you do is just helping to, hopefully, if it's successful, it's helping to let you move with the room that you have here. But now, to go beyond this point is where there must be transcendence. And so if you're okay with just going as much as you can there, that's all right. That's what you want. Unfortunately, most people don't even do that. They just are kind of in here. They're complaining, if any of the Ariadnic, Arivedic, Arivotic, and not taking responsibility in different ways to help themselves sufficiently. Most people are thinking it's just supposed to happen. And it will happen here as well as transcendence if their devotion, faith, is that strong. That's rare. It's rare that somebody is so strong that they can do like Raghunath Das, for instance. Raghunath Das Goswami to eat rotten food, rotten prasadam. And he wasn't affected by it. Because prasadam is prasadam. Prasadam is spiritual. Whether it's 1 year old or whether it's 1 hour, you know, off the offering and available, or 1 minute. But he could take that same prasadam and be totally blissful while his body, physical body, was deteriorating. He was quite sickly. But he was not distracted one iota. Haridas Thakur could just chant all day long. So yes, we have these models, we have these acharyas, and we are to follow their examples. But we have to be careful about imitation. Because imitation, unhealthily, it brings fall down, frustration. So, we should not discourage devotees who may need to work on their bodies and their minds like you work on a car or whatever, so it can be better to do what they have to do. We also should definitely let them know, hey, this is just work. This is body work. The problem is when devotees do this body work and they think that this is spirituality. No, it ain't spirituality. It's body work. Body work and mind work. At the same time, it's like if we are trying to preach and the building is all falling apart or the building is in shambles, who is going to want to come? So somebody says, you know, we're spiritualists. We shouldn't have to worry about, you know, fixing the front and doing the landscaping, doing this, doing that. I mean, after all, it's just material. People who are too distracted by that, we don't need to have them around us anyway. Let those come who only want to hear. No, it doesn't work like that. Otherwise, we see how Prabhupada built the wonderful, you know, Mayapur, Vrindavan projects in Delhi. All of these, because he realized, yes, we make more and more an attractive environment for people to come. We have more people coming and more people having chance to take advantage of the process. And how wonderful it is when people come to an environment, like here they come, there's beautiful dressed deities, and there's a beautiful building, and if there's nice prasadam, and the devotees are nice, then there's so many more reasons why they feel, I want to be like those people. So many more reasons why they feel, I want to go there. So many more reasons why they feel enlivened when they have a chance to come into the environment. The same philosophy being heard, and people are wondering, I was at one temple, excuse me, in Latin South America, and I was just worried the whole time I was giving the lecture because the ceiling was falling. I mean, it was just hanging. And then when it rained, and then sometimes the ceiling would fall more. And I was thinking, some people are not coming to this temple just because of that. Some people who've come here and they see that in your place of worship, in your temple room, that, you know, you got a bucket, you know, because the rain is coming, and you got pieces of plaster on the floor that somebody's sweeping up because the ceiling is falling. Some people are going to feel that maybe it's going to fall on me. Or some people are going to feel, I don't want to be around those people who somehow are so oblivious to something like this that needs to be fixed. What other stuff in their life and their philosophy that's like that? And people can take in different ones. Or somebody feels, I have no problem with the philosophy, but I don't want to be in that environment. I mean, people are influenced in different ways, of course, by bodily, you know, and social concerns. So do we say, you know, those people we're not interested in because they're not so serious. No, our duty is to be able to help everybody as much as possible to go on in their Krishna consciousness. Now, some people who may not even be so Krishna conscious, but if an environment is nice and pleasant, they will come and they will come and they will come. And then they'll become more Krishna conscious. They'll make more advancement. So you know, when I'm working, I'm at school, I'm at home, whatever, I just go to the Krishna temple, Krishna place. As soon as I come into the gate, I feel like I'm just in a whole other world. When I walk into, you know, their temple, and I just look at their, you know, the murtis, or I just hear their, you know, their kirtan, the bhajan, I just feel like life does have meaning. And I feel, you know, that I don't have to be so absorbed in identifying with what goes out there, because there is a healthy alternative. So we work on that in between to the maximum best way we can while we go deeper and deeper in our devotion. And we go beyond our karma, beyond the happiness or success that each person is going to have when they come into this material world anyway. There's certain things that is part of our experience in this lifetime that ain't going to be changed other than through the mercy from engaging more and more deeper in transcendence and getting the blessing of Guru and Krishna and getting more connection with the Shastra. So we are not those who are thinking that, okay, by taking to a religion, everything is going to fly away. No, we know. Taking to a spirituality, transcendence, is going to get worse in some cases. We realize that certain things, even though we're devotees, are going to be part of our life. But still, there's the Krishna variable we have to keep trying to grab for. Now, some of our devotees these days, because they were thinking naively themselves that by chanting Hare Krishna, everything was going to change according to how they wanted, and it didn't happen, and then they've lost a certain amount of faith, and they're taking more shelter of all of the kinds of modalities, and Krishna gets farther and farther in the background. So Maya has tricked them. Now they're getting all into new age things, and this alternative this, and this thing, and that thing. Yeah, but Haribo, where's Krishna? And then others have maintained certain kind of strict Krishna consciousness, and they're getting dry and bored, because in maintaining, they haven't gone deep enough to experience deeper inner life. And then they do not go to alternative things, this or that, but they just leave. They just start trying to make money. Feeling, well, I got to get money. I have to do this, do that. Yeah, that's true. They have to have money. But they don't have to give up Krishna in the process. They don't have to give up their connection with what they came into this world for. These other things they've done in many, many lifetimes. In so many lifetimes, they were noble with opulence and prestige, and they had wealth, and they had beauty, and they had fame, and they had wonderful so many things. They still had to come back to the material world to engage and hopefully getting ready to get out of this place. So we don't want to put a lot of energy into stuff that we've already done. You've been a professor. You've been a demigod. You've been a yogi. You've been a mystic. You've been a philosopher. You've been a wonderful wife, a wonderful husband. You've been a good student, a good child. You've had wealth. You lived in palaces. You've done all of that. So we don't want to get so much into trying to do that in this lifetime. We want to do the Krishna thing. And so Bhaktisiddhanta ends with these reflections. He talks about the importance of Nam, of Dham, and Kam. Of Nam, in order to really make these changes in our life, then we have to take more shelter, authentic shelter, of the Holy Name. Because we are calling the Lord. We are asking for His blessings. We are positioning ourselves as a needy who need facilitation. And it ain't easy to remain very loyal and faithful to chanting Hare Krishna when you see people have been chanting 20 and 30 years and going off into a huge sense gratification. It ain't very easy in chanting every day and then in some cases, in your own case, feeling like, hey, I don't feel any difference. Chanting for 15 years and being very consistent, not missing one day, your 16 rounds, and you still have lust, they still have fear, they still have so many different things. But one, we know that we channel with offenses. But also, we realize that especially in Kali Yuga, so many things we do as angas of bhakti, that if we do them loyally, then we get mercy, even if we don't see immediate transformation now. There's some things we do that we do because we've made this pledge to Prabhupada, and we do this. Now it's on the Prabhupada to do his part because we've done our part. It's not that I have to hear Krishna's flute one day, which is a real sign that my chanting is okay. Not really. I do my best. We must do our best. But more significant is that because Prabhupada is Nitya Siddha, he's Acharya, he's asked us to do this, and we have been loyal to that, then the four blessings are accessible. After all, in Kali Yuga, we do everything with so many offenses. Everything in an improper way. So we have all of these ninefold things that we do. When just one of them could bring one full God consciousness, if done with sufficient profundity, but we don't. And so we do these things, and we become a Prabhupada man, and we leave the body, and the devas arrange, oh, Krishna arranges, this is one of Prabhupada's grandchildren, he doesn't belong here, send him to the spiritual world. So, we get too fruitative and too much concerned about, you know, material stimulation and rewards and boons or whatever, and miss the point that this is a very awesome movement in philosophy, and it has so much to do with proper effort, but it has more to do with proper corresponding mercy. But the mercy comes in concatenation with the proper effort. With too much effort, then we're too much like Karmakan, the Karma Mimamsa people. With too much effort, we'll also get frustrated. Because we have a lot of effort, we may not get the kind of results when and how we expect. Because too much effort also means we're trying to be too much of the controller. And a lack of effort means that we are lazy and we're thinking that it's supposed to happen without performing our austerity. The Brahma made it very clear in the second canto that it must be austere. It's austerity that builds this universe up, and it's austerity that gets us out of here. There's no way of getting around austerity, which means we have to willingly inconvenience ourselves in certain areas for preaching, for our obligations and our duties to Krishna. That we're not just trying to be comfortable. You consider that as a religiosity. So this taking shelter of Nam does not necessarily mean that one day one is going to chant the Lord's name and boom, Krishna is going to appear with the flute and says, so you've been calling me, beloved, here I am. I'm even more beautiful than you thought, isn't it? No? It may happen. You may hear Krishna's ankle bells. You may hear his flutes. You may embrace him. That is there. But a sign of our success is not necessarily manifested in that way. That may not happen. It may never happen in this lifetime. But if we have been sufficient effort, consistency, then when we leave the body is where we really see the guru connection. Otherwise, what's the need for a guru? Guru can't compliment. Guru can't be a broker for you. Guru can't help you to rise above what your normal credits are. What's the need for a guru? Huh? All the prayers, the dedication, and the meditation every day in our life, we are meditating on guru if we're a proper disciple. Every single day we should be meditating. I'm doing this as an offering to my spiritual masters. And so that is where we find the most significant aspect of the guru-disciple connection. Because now, all the tests have taken place. And now, time for graduation. Big event, big time. Years gone on, couple years, 4 years under graduate school. Now, you have this final test that's there for getting your certificate, for getting your degree. All of that was for the degree. And now you realize, yes, I got my degree now. So with minimization of nam, we will miss out. And we'll just do many things that will add to some of our bewilderments and will prolong our unhealthy suffering. And then he mentions about dham. Is that it is so important. We know in the principles of Siddhanta Bhakti how important it is in associating in the holy dhams. Well, this is not just the physical involvement in going to the dhams. That's there. And even when we're physically there, we must be mentally absorbed. But it also means constantly, wherever we are, the holy dhams, while in this body, are a chance for us to go and to visit and to get surcharged and literally to be redirected. So while we have to be in this hellish prison, we are somewhat above identifying so much with the atmosphere of the prison. So sometimes we have to physically have that kind of transition in order to remind us about why what we do on a day-to-day basis, we have to be somewhat above it. Doing our very best, like the woman with the problem or lover, she's doing everything expertly, but the mind is somewhere else. The mind is with her real lover. So the holy dhams can remind us, or the temple, or the sacred pilgrimage places, they can remind us, because you live outside, and so you can be reminded when you come to the temple, and you see the deities, and you involve yourself in the process, in the culture of devotion, is to remind you that that is your real culture. This is your real identity. Things connected with the soul. And that what we have to experience and the acculturation is not what we really want to prioritize. So sometimes the coming to immediate temple situations or going to the holy dhams, we have many temples and many sacred places where pastimes have taken place and places that are very surcharged have the ability to refocus us. It's almost like putting us mentally in another dimension. It's like, you know, really mundane example. You're in a certain room in a certain place, you take intoxications and you get high. So you are there, but you are not fully there. You're having also an altered experience in consciousness. Bad example, but I think, you know, you can see the shift. So the idea is that, yeah, we're physically here, but we're altered state of awareness while we move on. Otherwise, we get so locked into thinking how mundane people think. We get so locked in the mundane people's priorities. And we start doing so many things only based on the priorities of the ordinary and the mundane and the prisoners of this particular universe. And then the devotee loses his resolve. I gave a program two days ago to, you know, a house of healers, psychotherapists, and doctors and whatnot. But people who are, you know, upbeat and they're on some kind of path. And I was focusing on how people can remain loyal. Because it's very difficult for those who are pursuing spiritual commitments and somehow to be able not to get distracted. Vaishnavas and Vaishnavas, people who are trying to be dharmic. It is very difficult in a very sinful world when everything is saying, just enjoy, just hang out, just try to do something to make your material existence a little better, and so you can call that success. But it brings in more entanglement. It's like the lie, you tell another lie, another lie. You try to fix something, and you make it worse. Of course, I would have preferred just to be able to speak to these people right on their face. Look, nothing's really going to change. You're going to suffer, because that suffering is there. You just have to chant Hare Krishna, follow these principles, and once and for all, get out of here. But as devotees, we're supposed to be like the Goswamis. We are to make devotees, be devotees ourselves. As Krishna comes, reclaim souls and take some directly back to the spiritual world. And he arranges the environment for people to grow. Some come back in later lifetimes. Bhaktisiddhanta explains that the average level of devotion takes 3 lifetimes before one goes back. Anyway, that's a whole other discussion. But Nam, Dham, that we have the Dhams where we realize this is my home. It's like your business, you're a person, you're traveling, and you're having a little roughness here, there, but you realize in 2 weeks I'll be back home. In my own mat or bed, my own room, preparing my own food, I'll be back. And it gives you a sense of, rejuvenation to tolerate what you're going through, because you realize I'll be back in my ashram, in my place, traveling around now, you're traveling Sankirtan, I'm going here, going there, and showering in the gas stations or whatever, at the truck stops. But soon I'll be back, I can go into my shower, I can do this, do that, and so you tolerate. So we realize the Dham can remind us we have our own home, a real home. And then Kama, which usually Kama means lust, it means the desires of the body. But here he refers to the Kama in terms of Krishna's pleasures, Krishna's desires. And this, I venture to say, is the most important. And this, Sridhananda was saying, I was explaining something last night, it separates the men from the boys, or it helps us look closer at religion versus spirituality, at mixed devotion versus pure devotion. This is the real issue here. And we'll see more manifestations of this, especially when we see sometimes people who've been very much involved and later getting distracted, or deviations in high circles. Is that at the end of the day, we can't fake putting Krishna in the center. If Krishna is not sufficiently in the center of our activities, there's going to be a certain degree of failure. And when Krishna is in the center in our activities, there's going to be a distinct degree of success. Now, outwardly, you can do a lot of stuff that can seem to have Krishna in the center and not really have Krishna in the center. And you will not get, we will not get the other proper spiritual results. So we do have to revisit and ask ourselves and help others to give us feedback as much as possible, and feedback through the Shastra. Looking closer, at Krishna's desires. What is genuinely going to nourish our real selves, which is offering things that Krishna is willing to accept to Krishna. Now, that means that there are certain things that we can do that may not even be the core of what we normally understand to be devotional service. But if Krishna's in the center, is blessed. And there's certain things that we can do in the confines of devotee association. And if Krishna is not in the center, it's contamination. And putting Krishna in the center has more to do with what is going on in our minds than what is done with our physical activity. Now, we don't say, you can take intoxications, you can do sinful things, and you can offer that to Krishna, or you can put Krishna to center with that. No, that doesn't happen. But even with things that are not sinful, there are gradations of how much Krishna is actually in the center. And when Krishna is not sufficiently in the center, it's exploitation. If one is using or working with others, Krishna is not sufficiently in the center. It's like we're trying to bribe or cheat Krishna. And he knows it. And so he will do various things to us, with us, for us, to help us to see, you are cheating me. And you have to come forth with the real deal. Because you're cheating that I am helping you, or I'm exposing you, or I am putting you in a fallen state. But I'm really revealing that you're already fallen because you're not putting me in the center. So let's summarize. Today we've talked about a verse that emphasizes the danger in trying to fix something and making it worse. There's a certain amount of happiness and distress that one is going to encounter. But that we don't just accept, you know, predestination. That we do work on ourselves, and we should constantly be working for improvement. Because we work for improvement, we do remind ourselves of the cow tied to the post. That there's so much that needs to be done to stretch the rope. But even after that's done, there's such a need for deeper bhakti, deeper devotion. So we go beyond what the rope is able to do. So much self-improvement, so much economic growth, economic development, so much whatever only is going to stretch the rope, which is necessary and it's good. Because from that, then now you can go more. Even after all that's said and done, we look and must look to see, are we pleasing Krishna? Are we really offering to Krishna? Or are we trying to do something and dovetail and then tell Krishna, accept this because this is what I want to do? And there's a fine line of doing for Krishna and doing for ourselves. There's a fine line in getting distracted with failure or success. Success distracts us sometimes even more than failure. Failure surely distracts us, bewilders us, causes us to question everything about ourselves and about life. And so we want to be more fixed in taking more shelter of the chanting. Be more fixed in honoring the conception of the Dham. And be more focused in looking closer at what is Krishna's desire. And being ready to joyfully proceed according to what is Krishna's desire. Realizing that will that will bring us success. See, as we go on and on in our devotional service, Krishna's desire becomes even more important. In our neophyte stages, we do things, you know, pretty mechanically. We can follow the principles, you know, pretty mechanically. And we have a certain amount of novelty and zeal because we think we're going to become. Was Utsaha Maya, I think, Shri Krishna talked about, explains. We first come, we have a certain amount of pride, and we're kind of thinking we're going to become a pure devotee, you know, maybe in a week or so. You know, maybe by next Janmasa we'll be pure. So we have that kind of sort of interesting raw enthusiasm and pride. And after a while, you know, that kind of goes because you got to deal with the real stuff. And then we go on for so many years and years and years, and we see all kind of things happening around us, and disappointments, and we lose a certain amount of faith in a lot of things. And that's to be expected, but it shouldn't stay there. Then our faith has to go deeper into connecting more, you know, with Krishna's desires. Deeper in understanding more about the conception of Dham, being in this world but not of this world. Deeper in having this hunger to return back, because that's what our real problems are, is that we're out of station. And so our problems are always going to be there since we're out of our home. Nothing's going to fix that. When Krishna says, Namay Bhakta Apanashati, my devotee should not perish, he's saying, well, ultimately, I am going to do the necessary to reward my devotee. But he doesn't say in between all of those lives and existences that my devotees are going to catch hell. Perhaps my devotee will catch even more hell as he tries to run away, you know, from the grips of Maya. So we do have a very awesome philosophy, a very awesome spiritual culture that is just amazing, and is also very bewildering how we can have so many challenges with such a royal process. And as we are honest about some of these kind of challenges, we can move through them a lot easier, and we can struggle together as we, you know, as we move through them. Otherwise, we kind of suffer, you know, individually, and we get overwhelmed, or we do certain things that just adds to the bewilderment, or adds to the unhealthy karma, you know, that we're trying to get free of. And the last thing is that we just become so tired that we get this far and we start, you know, backtracking. When you almost finish it with a race, you get really tired, huh? You think, oh, okay, I'm tired of this. Let me just stop. Some examples. You can think I'm tired, or you can think I'm tired because I've gone so far and I only get another half a mile to finish. So let me get this second win and finish this last mile. A lot of devotees these days are very tired. 55 years old now. They're 60 years old. 65 years old. So they're physically exhausted. They're mentally challenged. They're tired of paying mortgages, paper mortgages many, many times. They're tired of paying for this, for that. They're tired of hearing about another person deviating. They're tired about another thing, another this, another that. They become overwhelmed. They have to realize everyone has their contract with, you know, with Krishna. And we'll be even more tired if we have to come back for, you know, a couple of more lifetimes. So, better to finish it now. Nam, Dam, and Kam. Any questions? It is quite amazing. Where does the free will start? Where does it stop? What does predestination kick in? It's quite interesting.
You were talking about the past. That seems to be very prevalent mentality as you travel around. What is the difference between maintaining standards that Prabhupada established and living in the past? And if you have to adjust for the defined circumstance mission, but it seems like the Prabhupada is, well, we just did things the way Prabhupada told us that we were going to have all these problems. And, you know, sometimes it appears to sort of blind follow that, well, we have to make adjustments, but at the same time, if standards are maintained and Prabhupada established, how can we expect mercy of
Prabhupada? Prabhupada himself addressed this issue, you know, about change. And he said, you know, it takes intelligence. Of course, spiritual intelligence, because every acharya changed a lot of things. And every acharya was very concerned about change, where you just become politically correct and the essence gets thrown away, you just become another religion, another philosophical group, etc. But every acharya was alive and dynamic and merciful. And so they were fixed in trying to see how the best way to, you know, to get the essence. Look at the tremendous things that Prabhupada changed. And even today, so many of the members of Gaudiya Math and other Vaishnava lines have an issue with Prabhupada because of the things about changing so much. And Bodhisattva changed as much, even more. And Bodhisattva changed so many. And you can make you can write a whole book on just the changes. Some we say that we have to do as the Prabhupada had gave us, then we have to do that by what was given as well as with the essence. And we see that some things Prabhupada changed, you know, so not to change. Some things he changed, as he emphasize about the holy name, and wanted to do 64 rounds and 32 and then 16 rounds. His Prabhupada initiated women. Brahma initiation is he had women to live in the temples. He said women to go out and do sankirtan. I mean, so many things he did. So many things he did that we can definitely say if he was here, he wouldn't do it the same way, even now. Any more than the Prabhupada showed that when he was on the planet. First, he was personally arranging, facilitating the marriages. He stopped due to our not following through properly. He stopped. So there's some things he would have to look at again. Prabhupada was on the planet. He wanted us to have our children in the ashrams. And we see it was the ashrams that so many other children, you know, were sexually abused. The ashram life is wonderful when so many other things are also in place. But presently, not putting children in ashrams is very dangerous. I mean, everything is dangerous, but it's, you know, it's even more more questionable, or it's more susceptible, more likelihood that an abuse can take place. And that's where there's a big problem. Because what do we know, and how do we know, and when do we know when to change? Even though I'm a really kind of a change agent type person, I feel best to be conservative and to maintain what has been previously given exactly as it was given. That will hold the house somewhat together, but it will not develop it. A very conservative position can maintain, hopefully. But then at the same time, a radical position can just cause bewilderment and confusion. And it can give license, that's unhealthy. It can open up a floodgate. And that's where we have to be more humble and susceptible, more susceptible to mercy. Either way, there's risk. I see tremendous apparatus going on in the ultra-conservatives. I see tremendous lack of faith in the bleeding liberals. The bleeding liberals want to accommodate everything and everybody, and they're feeling it's all going to work out. You try to do this, you do this, you do this. Unity and diversity. Yes, unity and diversity works when there is more unity than diversity. When you have more diversity than unity, unity and diversity doesn't work. You just get anarchy. So unity, even unity and diversity, it has its own boundaries. And it's an issue that our movement is actually being very much confronted with. Those who have lost faith for different reasons and really are substituting other things for their sadhana. And there's the ultra-conservatives who are so stuck in stone that they're missing the fact that every acharya was so much full of compassion, they were constantly finding ways to reach out to help people. I think later when some books come out on the life of Bodhisiddhanta, we're going to be shocked to see how he was so strict and how he was so innovative, like unbelievably innovative. And Bhaktivinoda's life shows it also. Of course, the acharyas, they have certain license, you know. But it just shows the spirit that to propagate a movement, especially a worldwide movement, it involves, you know, a lot of strategy. And it's like a war. You have to be doing the bombing. You have to be preparing for other places you're going to bomb. You got to equip people with nourishment, with food, with shelter. You got all of these things, and all of this is part of the war. Just to think that war is only bombing. It takes a lot of things to get the person on the front line and to maintain that person on the front line. So sometimes one is thinking, we just have to go back into doing Harinam every day, distributing books on the streets every day, and everything is going to work out. Yes and no. Yes, we do have to give more focus to those things. But we also, while doing that, we have to give more focus into healthy grihastha life, healthy economic development. We have to give more focus to a proper security so devotees, when they do those things, they can even do it with more potency. And that when people come and visit us, they feel more that there is a community, you know, that's alive, and there are people who are doing something, you know, that they can identify with. So it's like in any other institution, is that you have your ultra conservatives, you have your moderates, you have your radicals, and it's all different, you know, all different gradations. We really shouldn't be thinking so much of being conservative, moderate, radicals. We should be thinking about being Krishna conscious. And Krishna conscious is very conservative in some areas and very radical in other areas, but it's always compassion. See, the danger of the ultra conservatives exist by the annihilation of an enemy. So they have to constantly have an enemy that they're attacking, that they see is disturbance. And so they are constantly in an enemy-friend consciousness. And the leading liberals are constantly trying to see how to get everybody involved, and they gradually, you know, minimize principles and potency. Which is more dangerous? They both are dangerous. But in one sense, I personally feel the ultra-conservatives are more dangerous because their nature is that they make avarats. The liberals, they just do this crazy thing and they make more and more work and more and more work, and hopefully if they have a good heart, they find out that they made a mistake. And they waste a whole lot of time and bring a lot of confusion. I mean, I'm more toward the liberal side, but I find that the ultra conservatives are too fast to be offensive because they have too much sense of self-righteousness, which is very dangerous. See, we're going to have to deal more with this as devotees and as people in the world. Because of all the fanaticism and all the eclectic stuff going on, we're going to have to deal more and more as we exist and preach. People are going to confront you. What do you feel about abortion? What is your understanding of homosexuality? People are going to confront you. And how you answer that, they're going to mark you. And we have to be ready to deal with this so that somehow we can be loyal to our philosophy while we don't just shut people out who we're supposed to be able to help. Some people may be beyond our help, but some people aren't. And we have to address these where we are holding on to the philosophy, maintaining it, but at the same time, we are able to reach and communicate with more and more people. Just certain buzzwords and certain things, because of what's happened in society, cause people to go into a certain mindset. Somebody asks you, so what do you think? I mean, it's like now, you know, I mean, my spiritual way of Tupac, I'm going to re-edit it. Because although we know what our position is on homosexuality, there's a couple of parts in there that can just cause somebody to feel that we are homophobic. And we're not. We're concerned about the soul. We're concerned about everyone. And we're concerned about those who are needy even more, because we know that Lonijananda is most merciful. And so therefore, we have to be careful that we don't hide what we are. Even if we're not able to preach as much as we would like to straight on somebody's face, we should be careful not to hide the fact that we have a certain commitment, that we have a certain identity, and we should be proud of that. And some people will, if they like us, then they will inquire more about what we do and how we do it. But we are supposed to be those people who are Vaishnavas, who are able to help the world to be more dharmic, so people can also become Sanatana Dharmis. And we are supposed to be those who are honoring Sanatana Dharma, are not throwing out Dharma. That's one of the biggest failures of ISKCON at this point, is that while we're trying to be engaged in Sanatana Dharma, we so often throw out Dharma. And it comes back to haunt us. In our economics, in our relationships, and even maintaining our own mental stability. That in order for Sanatana Dharma to be healthily embraced, Dharma must be in place. Any other questions?
Well, the growth of Mecca.
The growth of Mecca. Mecca, in its real essence, is about going outside of the material body, outside of the material world, and returning to paradise. Paradise, as we look closer at paradise, it is the heavenly environment, heavenly kingdoms. Heavenly kingdoms are not necessarily a distraction to the spiritual world. Abrahmana, Bhuvana, Loka, from the highest to the lowest, our place is still of misery and of the duality. For a devotee who is ready to accept a lifestyle, the only connection with the heavenly kingdoms, then that is a problem. But for a devotee who honors that, knows there are heavenly kingdoms, there are devas, there are demigods, apsaras, vijaharas, it's not a problem. You see it, that this is part of Krishna's massive creation. There's not war between the different, you know, designations that one can go to, heavenly kingdoms, Dwarka, Mathura, to the Vaikunthas. These are all places that the soul can go based on the quality of devotion. They don't take away from the spiritual world. They don't take away from Vrindavan. Any last questions?
Relating to the verse, making any adjustments in the material world, just simply leads to, practically speaking, an identical form of misery. Related to the sentiment of being attached to the firmer method and not being just in the, and neglecting the standard. Substituting some other alternative method, it just seems quite better than the standards what's given in the books, and proof of it is that we've substituted the previous scriptural standard with an alternative modern rendition, and evidence proves that we've simply accommodated a new form of mystery. I think we're putting together what you're both saying.
But the real question is, what is the standard? You see, the standard is Sadhu, Shastra, and Guru, of course. And there is interpretation within that. And that's where we have to be careful. So you consider exactly what is the standard. What is the standard for a good householder, you know, raising children? And there is some, you know, there's some interpretation in there, you know, based on the standard. Is it improper if a householder does not send their child, you know, to live in Gurukula? That was a standard that was given to us when Srila Prabhupada was on the planet. Would a householder be considered fallen, deviant, lacking faith, if they are not ready and thinking and preparing their child to go and live in Gurukula? And so that was given to us as Prabhupada's standard. Now some people will say, yes, if you don't send your child even now to live in an ashram, then you're not adhering to Prabhupada's standard. And then all consequences that come from that, negative, is your fault. But then someone will say, I mean, some of the devotees I find, then with the greatest pain are some of the mothers and fathers who have been consistent, good devotees. Sent their children, since we talked last night about children, so we'll talk about children. Sent their children to the Gurukulas. The day their children are not devotees because of the sexual abuse that they encountered in the Gurukula. And that parent has to juggle sometimes with the natural anxiety of a parent who wants the best for their child, feels that what they tried to arrange for the best of their child has caused their child to to discard and even to hate their religion. And that parent has to deal with the fact, in some cases, that they had the motherly intuition that they shouldn't, do this. And even sometimes the child, contacted them and expressed their anxiety. But because that parent was trying to follow that standard, they told the child, they just kept the child listening to Guru Kula. So we see that standard was okay, given other things were also proper. But other things are not presently proper, then we can't say somebody who doesn't do like that, this is a sign, that they're deviant. Or somebody who did do like that, it's a sign that they're better devotee. Even though, their child is in Maya. Because Krishna sent them some soul, to take care of. And then someone who just says, that's the standard, and that's your karma, and you have to do this. So we understand there is some truth to that, but also there is also some interplay within the karma. So, it's kind of complex. So the ultra-conservative may say, no, we just have to do this, maintain these ashrams, and send the children there, and we just have to deal with the consequences. Or we have to just be, better devotees. And they're right, we're better devotees. And all that's in place. But the reality is that we don't have all of those things in place. And now the person says, let's just send the kid to Karmi school and just, send him down the river. That's also a problem. So if you send the child to school, then you still have responsibility for your child to see that they get sufficient spiritual and cultural support while they're getting, the academic degree. At some university or someplace, whatever. The responsibility is still there. It's not so black and white. And that's why there is need for honest feedback as we move in these areas to be able to look again at what can be refined, what needs to be fixed a little better. But when we have too much of the kind of polarization, then it gets more polarization. Because the super eclectics are causing the conservatives to become more conservative. And the ultra-conservatives are causing the eclectics to even go more farther out. You've kind of seen some of this, in Alatra, where you see some people just, first they get into a little wrecky and then this and that, and next thing they go everywhere, they're rushing to be on time, all of these workshops, all these meetings, they won't miss it, but they won't rush, to be in time for the meeting of the deities. They're so eager to do this, music modality, and at the same time, they've enchanted Hare Krishna 16 rounds in 6 months. Then it becomes, into 6 years. Okay, any last question? Anyway, these are just things for us all to think about and may give us more headache, than resolution. But we see how the acharyas have an awesome task. And then how all they're really concerned about is getting us out of here. They're really concerned about getting us out of all of the combinations of this prison and how to run this way, and that way. But they find ways to pacify us as they're trying to get us out of here. So certain things, put in place help us to get out of here faster. That's what we're really concerned with. How do we put certain things in place so that it helps to get us into higher consciousness, even in this body, and gets us back to the spiritual world? And what needs to be maintained, what needs to be adjusted, so that we definitely are putting Krishna in this center, Krishna Kama. And when that's there, then there's constant growth. And we're not, whether we're eclectic or ultra-conservative, Krishna's not in the center. And it's going to bring more of the entanglement, that this verse talks about. ISKCON found the jar of divine grace, A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada ki. Hare Krishna. Thank you.
Thank you.